Support for Pray Public is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org. And by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, it's a busy election year, and we'll hear from Kirsten Baszler, who's running to keep her seat as Superintendent of Public Instruction. But health is on our mind as we begin the show today. Ashley, what do you have for us?
Well, there is this line out there when it comes to monitoring major health concerns. Many third world and developing nations battle things like infectious diseases, malaria and what have you, while those of us in the developed world are more likely to deal with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes. And much of that is because of our lifestyles, lots of sitting, eating processed foods. Today, we visit with Dr. Stephanie Meyer, a certified lifestyle medicine professional. She's also the director of wellness and an assistant professor of exercise science at Concordia College. Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
What is a lifestyle medicine professional?
Yeah. So lifestyle medicine is a field of science, and it's been around for 20 years this year as kind of an organization. So what this field of lifestyle medicine is, it's an evidence-based approach of using lifestyle change as treatment. So if you think of medicine, Western medicine, like many of us are used to here, you often think of different treatments that can kind of be used to treat a very specific symptom, but not actually get rid of whatever the disease might be kind of growing into, where lifestyle medicine is looking at lifestyle change to treat chronic illnesses, such as type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension, so that you don't have the symptoms of those diseases anymore. It doesn't just stop them from getting worse. You actually want to reverse the chronic illness progression. And so that's the field of lifestyle medicine, and I am certified in that field of science.
So this is sort of the people who say, you mentioned some chronic illnesses, and places like the CDC and the NIH are saying upwards of 80% of chronic illnesses can be prevented with lifestyle changes. What are some of the lifestyle changes that we can be implementing here?
The field of lifestyle medicine is foundational with six pillars. So I can list those off and kind of talk about those a little bit. So the pillars are included physical activity, so getting enough exercise or movement, eating nutritious whole foods, avoiding harmful substances, stress management, having good social connections, is another one.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I mentioned them all there. And getting some good sleep. I think I mentioned that one.
Yep.
So those are super foundational to healthy living. And, you know, the word healthy, people can have different various definitions of what they think that is. But if we think about kind of the best quality of life that we can create for ourselves, if we focus on those six things, we're upwards, like you mentioned, 80% of chronic illness can be prevented, but we can also engage in these behaviors to reverse a trend that we might be on of maybe some not great behaviors or health functions. So we can actually use them to treat as well as to prevent. And you mentioned CDC, they really focus on prevention a lot, which is great. However, the current patterns and pathways that we are using for preventing chronic illness, they're not working because we're continuing to have an increase in chronic illness. So it's really important, and this lifestyle medicine field really is trying to get a shift in kind of the healthcare mindset as well, that we can't just be talking about lifestyle as prevention, which is super important. We have to start using it as treatment as well. So that's the only way we're going to start to shift this direction of chronic illness burden.
How many of these sort of chronic illness burdens that you're talking about are happening in much higher percentages in the United States and other very developed countries that have a lot of similar lifestyles?
Yeah, good question. So it's definitely connected to more of the developed countries is the chronic illness burden. There's something called the epidemiological shift or epidemiological transition, not to get too sciencey, but that's something that you kind of watch. And as countries go from maybe undeveloped to more of a developed country like the United States, you see a shift from infectious disease issue and uncontrolled infectious diseases to then uncontrolled chronic illnesses. And that really has to do with our lifestyle change and what we have access to, as you kind of mentioned before, on these lifestyles, and are they easy to do? And they're not, which they seem like they should be, because it's things that we know. We know common sense wise, we know fruits and vegetables are good for our bodies. We know moving our bodies is good for us. We know getting enough sleep is good for us.
Right.
But it's not necessarily easy to do.
Our drive-throughs.
Right. And so especially when our communities are built in a way and our culture is built in a way that doesn't value those things as much. We value kind of the large coffee, caffeinated drinks and whatnot. It becomes very difficult to live that lifestyle on a regular basis.
That's really interesting what you said, when our community and our culture is built that way. What do you mean by that? Specifically, when our communities are built a specific way, how does community design impact health?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Many times I like to kind of debunk maybe this myth that especially people who have decided, you know, I'm going to, let's just say, lose weight. That's such a common one. It's in the news a lot right now, the weight loss stuff. If you're at a point where you're deciding I'm going to be healthier, so that's just one example. And then they realize that everything around them is built and designed to really not help them to, again, lose weight, eat healthier, exercise, fill in the blank. What happens is that what's around us really does have an impact on the choices we're able to make and if we feel supported. And many times we as individuals think we have a lack of willpower and we blame ourselves for not being able to do whatever the healthy item is that we want to do, to really change our health behavior, to be health promoting for what we need it to be. We blame ourselves and we think we don't have enough motivation to do it. Something must be wrong with us, which in fact, who we surround ourselves with, the people that we surround ourselves with, up to three times, kind of three people removed from us, impact our behaviors and choices, whether we realize it or not. Yeah, like the sidewalks or lack of sidewalks is just one really common example. So physical built spaces, as well as then the things we have access to and the people we surround ourselves with, really have a large, much larger impact on us environmentally than we do personally with our own kind of motivations.
We're visiting today with Dr. Stephanie Meyer. She is an assistant professor of exercise science and the wellness director at Concordia College. She is also a certified lifestyle medicine professional. And we are talking today about lifestyle medicine. And Dr. Meyer, earlier you mentioned these kind of six pillars of health, and really intriguing that you would say something like up to three people removed can impact our health decisions, but also going back to those six pillars, that sort of social health component being really important. What if your group of friends that you love to hang out with maybe doesn't have the healthiest eating or physical movement activities, but they're the kind of people that you really connect with on some sort of other level? What are some sort of guidelines for balancing that emotional health with the physical health?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I might answer this in kind of two different directions. So social connection in and of itself is important for our overall well-being. So let's think of it, if you don't have positive social connections, whatever that might mean to you. So I would maybe say, if you have a social group you're hanging out with, but they're not promoting the rest of your physical health, are they really good for your social health? And so I would maybe question. So if I would be working with you as a client or, as a small group or something, that would be something that would show up on my assessment to say, well, you're saying, that these are your social groups, but then all these other areas of your life are really struggling because of how much time you're spending in this social group. So it would be a really great point of maybe introspection on what's going on there. And I have had that happen when I've worked with people to say, you know, when you're with this group, one of the pillars is avoiding risky substances. And when people are with a certain group, oftentimes they might indulge in too many, you know, risky substances or behaviors. And so it's really time to kind of look at that. That's on one kind of one hand of things. The other one, though, is, you know, you can have more than one social group for whatever that need is. You know, if you've got a group that is parents of kids that your kids are friends with, and that's different than another social group that you have when you don't want to talk about school related activities, that's okay. And kind of knowing how those different social groups feed your overall kind of sense of purpose and sense of well-being, that's what's most important about those social groups.
Yeah, talk about that part of health, the point of being that sense of purpose and that sense of being and how that can impact your health decisions. If I've had a bad day at work, boy, do I eat pretty crappy.
Right. So that your social well-being, your sense of purpose, that can be connected a lot. What you just mentioned there, it can be connected to stress management. So who we spend our time with, what kind of things happen in a day, social emotional responses and experiences we have, as well as then managing our stress response. I mean, it's really hard to kind of tease them apart in this specific maybe example of what do we do when, or how does our social situation impact what happens when we go home at night? And then the behaviors that we engage in, a lot of it is kind of all balled up into one thing. But that stress response of, are we recognizing what's going on and how we're feeling? Do we have more days where we're wondering why we spent all day doing that thing and how it's not really serving what we enjoy doing, or why we feel like we're here using our skills? You know, those things are really, really important to then everything else, like you mentioned, to then what we choose to eat or not eat, or if we're feeling like we want to engage in physical activity, what kinds of substances we choose to use as maybe coping, and we don't realize it because it's just, again, going back to the culture and our environment, it's just kind of the normal thing that we do after, like you said, a long day.
Yeah, that's interesting because it ties into the stress management sector of that six pillars. Is there a difference between stress avoidance and stress management?
Yeah, you can't really avoid stress, although we really try to ignore it maybe, or not deal with it and hope it goes away. But here's the good news. When I talk about stress, I talk about there is like a good side of it, because stress is mostly a perception of physical or emotional tension that we feel. So we have real physical tension and we have real emotional tension that we feel. However, stress is how we respond to these things. So this is the good news, is that because it's a function of our mind, we can do things about it. We can have influence over how we react to situations. So we might not always be able to remove ourselves from a stressful situation that we're either going through for short term or long term, but we can influence how we respond to it with things like exercising is so, so good for our feelings of stress and being able to kind of manage our emotions, as well as meditation. There's walking meditations. You can build in exercise and meditation at the same time. There's things like yoga, and there's so many different types of yoga that we could talk for a long time about that. So there's so many different things that you can do that are not trying to avoid the stress, which I would say things like using substances just tries to get rid of the feeling of the tension in that point in time, which it's effective, right? And it's point in time, but it's not a long-term solution.
Is working too much also a way to avoid health issues?
Avoid dealing with them maybe,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so anytime we maybe over-fixate on something. So your example, working too much.
Asking for a me.
Right. That's a tricky one because it depends on if we feel a strong sense of purpose in the work we do, you know, it could be that too. So I don't want to say it's all one thing.
Sure.
Because many times with feeling like we are doing a job or a vocation that we are absolutely meant to do and we love everything about it, we can kind of get pulled into it and not realize that there's other people in our life or there's other things in the world that we could be doing too for a little more balance. But it could be that we just are really feel called to do this thing, this job, this occupation really well. So that's kind of one side of it. But yes, the other side can be, are we always working because we don't want to deal with other things? Because it's not hard to live a healthy lifestyle, but it's hard to choose to, because really so much, like I mentioned before, of our environment is working against us. And especially that social piece, again, I'm going to kind of bring all these pillars back together because they're so related. And if you are someone who's decided to make some more healthy changes, and you don't have that support, or you kind of have to work uphill against your social circle a little bit, it can be challenging right away.
Years ago, there were these billboards that had doctor advice, and it was, if you could change just one thing.
It was
wear sunscreen or drink more water or don't eat at your desk or something like that. And I know there is never just one thing that you can do. But what are some of the more common concerns that are happening, you know, now because of the lifestyle of 21st century life in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do have an answer to this question. It's unfortunately, it's not physical activity, and that's my background. I'm an exercise physiologist by training, first of all, and you should still exercise. But the best thing, if you're going to pick one thing, is to eat whole foods, mostly plants, and not too much. And that's a quote from Michael Pollan, who wrote a book a while back, doing some research on kind of looking around the world in the United States on some things with healthy living. And really, if you're going to do one thing or start in one place, is look for plant-based foods and whole foods. Try not to buy those processed foods that are so easy to find in our lifestyle, is really setting us up to kind of think we need to do that all the time. But that's what I would say. If you could do one thing, eat whole foods, mostly plants, and not too many of them. Mm.
Going back to the people that you kind of surround yourself with and the impacts on your health, obviously there's family. and families, yes, they can be similar, but families can be remarkably different and have an impact on our health. And specifically things like genes. Let's talk a little bit about genetics and how those can really impact our health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. So there's a couple things we could talk about with genetics. First, I'm going to kind of start more in the space of talking about our environment and cultural impacts again, I think, since we've been talking about that. I'll do that first. So especially when we think about things like hypertension, right? We go into the doctor and we take a look at our family history and our risk factors. And so we look at how many of your family members have high blood pressure, hypertension, how many have had type 2 diabetes, right? So we answer those questions and we kind of look for risk that way. So that's a thing. However, more impactful to the chronic disease risk, like those examples I just mentioned, is our environment and the choices that we make around foods and exercise and tobacco and alcohol. So just because we might have a risk factor for some of those things, like again, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, does not mean you're going to get it. Mm-hmm. And lifestyle and our environment has a much stronger influence on the trajectory of those risks. Now, on the other side of things, we're learning a lot about what's called epigenetics. I am not someone who does research in this area, so I can really only talk to the cursory of it. But what we are learning, especially kind of looking at the nutrition side of things, is what we put in our bodies does impact future generations through that kind of genetic, the genetic line that happens with kind of the next generation that is born. And so there's definitely some research coming out with epigenetics, and what we're putting in our bodies does matter for future generations.
What about things like addiction?
Oh, right.
If you're the child of an addict, are you automatically just in a position where your friends are meeting at a bar and you can't go because your parents are alcoholics, or what are some things you have to keep in mind there?
Addiction is a disease of the brain. And this is maybe more of a newer way of thinking of addiction than maybe generations past have thought of addiction. Again, I go back to human nature is one where we always want to blame ourselves because we think we have this lack of willpower and we should just be able to figure it out and will ourselves to make the right choices. But especially with something like addiction, upwards of 50% of addiction does stem from a genetic predisposition. So it doesn't mean that you're automatically going to have a problem if you have a parent that had an addiction to maybe alcohol or another substance, but it means that, you know, 50% is one of the highest kind of genetic predispositions that you can have, especially with any type of an addicting substance. I mean, it could be gambling as well. I just know more about addiction with kind of alcohol and drugs. So it's something that we don't talk about enough. And if I could tell people listening anything about kind of, if you think substances are something that you want to use for whatever reason, casually or otherwise, you really should kind of think about your family history and conversation. The unfortunate part is we don't talk about it because there's stigma, it's embarrassing, it's difficult. There's so many feelings and emotions that go into it. Because again, we think that we should just be able to figure it out ourselves. And the reality is addiction is a disease of the brain. And so we need to be talking about it just like we do diseases of the rest of our physical body.
So often we think of the word medicine as a thing. It's like a pill or a shot. Mm-hmm. You take it, you have a specific problem, you take the medicine to fix the specific problem. How do you think of the word medicine when you've got a word like lifestyle in front of it?
The field of lifestyle medicine and how I think of it is that it's not alternative medicine. That's maybe something I want to say what it's not, because sometimes we'll think of like it's this alternative way of being. And in fact, lifestyle medicine is Western medicine. It's using the same science that we use to figure out a hypertension pill, but it's using food. It does similar things within the body. It's just we don't have the side effects of using food that we might have if using some other kind of created products. So it's really taking science that we've had around for a long time. There's really, really solid evidence on how we can treat and reverse diseases with stress management, food, nutrition, exercise, not using these toxins, toxic substances, and we can reverse and treat things just like we can with other created medicines. So it might seem like, well, that's a strange thing to think about, but it really is using the same foundational science as it would be as if we were using some type of pharmaceutical.
How do you work with your students at Concordia?
Yeah, so my position at Concordia is to teach all first-year students 2 credits of wellness. And so we have the approach where we take a 7 dimensions of wellness approach. And within that, I include all of these pillars of lifestyle medicine. So that the idea is that we can start early on when students are learning to develop their own young adult lifestyle habits out on their own, so that they can learn some of these behaviors and foundational reasons for why they would want to engage in some of these foundational behaviors and give them the tools to do that. There's multiple types of self-assessments to take to kind of reflect on what are your behaviors, what are your values and things that are important to you, and what health promoting behaviors can you engage in or learn from within the classes that we do at Concordia.
Dr. Stephanie Meyer, an assistant professor of exercise science and the wellness director at Concordia College. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, a candidate interview with Kirsten Baszler. That's coming up after this.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Fargo Police Chief is asking the City Commission and State Legislature for assistance in helping curb the city's public safety and quality of life issues on the streets. Chief Dave Zabolski says at the beginning of the pandemic, law enforcement agencies across the country began to see increases in reckless driving, motorists fleeing from police, and more vehicles being outfitted with unlawful enhancements, such as illegal mufflers and loud exhaust. Those things have not subsided and have, in fact, gotten worse. And Zabolski says with traffic fines as low as they are in North Dakota, law enforcement efforts are not often a deterrent. Zabolski even says doubling fines would not intimidate motorists.
Yeah, I was just talking to a guy randomly the other day who was from Minnesota, and he was talking about driving through Fargo and he's on the interstate. And he said, I didn't realize how fast I was going. Next thing you know, I got pulled over. And I go, yeah. And he goes, but then the guy, you know, said how much I was over, and he was giving me a ticket, and I said, how much is it? And the trooper told me $20, and he goes, I kind of chuckled, and I thought, well, can I pay you right here, and then I'll be on my way. It's not slowing anybody down.
Zabolski says prior efforts to ask the legislature to intervene have not been successful, but legislative fixes are what's needed to address the current one-size-fits-all approach. As UND continues to master its plan for campus renovations, more buildings are being repurposed and renovated, and others will be coming down, such as the Hislop Sports Arena.
Hislop has aged out.
UND President Andrew Armacost says such things as asbestos removal will begin January of 2025, and the building will come down in the spring of 2025.
And that will make room for the new STEM complex, which is the science, technology, engineering, and math.
Armacost says the master plan looks at which buildings need to be taken down and which buildings could be modernized. He says the plan will be updated.
We've had great success, and we need to really think forward beyond that to areas of biosciences and health, and how do we create the right spaces for both our physicians, our nurses, and our health professions programs. And then flight operations, of course, is a big one. It's the number one flying program in the country, and we need to make sure that their spaces are suitable as well and modernized.
Work has already been done on residence halls as well as other facilities. And North Dakota's Workforce Safety and Insurance Department is launching a new program to promote safety in the workforce. It's called Get Home Safe.
Recognizing the potential threats posed by workplace injuries, we're on a mission to make sure that safety is a fundamental aspect of your daily work life and ensuring that your lifestyle remains secure.
WSI Director Art Thompson says the agency is launching an online resource for businesses, large and small, to promote safety in the workspace. He says in 2022, there were 18,000 injuries on the job and 12 fatalities. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The contest to become North Dakota's next superintendent of public instruction is a nonpartisan race. Four candidates will be competing to move on from the upcoming June 11th primary election, and those candidates are Kirsten Baszler, James Paul Jim Bartlett, Darko Draconic, and Jason Heitkamp. We will hear from Jim Bartlett tomorrow and Jason Heitkamp on Wednesday. Mr. Draconic has not responded to our repeated request to be interviewed here at Prairie Public. Today, we hear from Kirsten Baszler, who was first elected to the office of State Superintendent of Public Instruction in November of 2012. She is again seeking re-election to the office. Kirsten, welcome to Main Street.
It's good to be here, Craig. Thank you.
Kirsten, first, why do you think you're the best qualified candidate to continue in the position of Superintendent of Public Instruction?
Certainly. I think growing up in a small town in southwestern North Dakota, I learned the Class B value of hard work and faith. You need those two things to provide the servant leadership that I believe our students and their families deserve. I worked first as a teacher's aide, then a classroom teacher, vice principal, district office leader in Bismarck, and I was a school board president in Mandan. So essentially, I've spent the last 34 years preparing students for life after graduation as my top priority. My three sons were all educated in North Dakota public schools, and my three granddaughters will soon be educated in those schools as well. So it makes me even more passionate about developing all students into the knowledgeable citizens that have respect, courage, integrity, a sense of responsibility, and most importantly, a deep appreciation for the unique nature of this great nation. So in the last 12 years, I've kept North Dakota at the leading edge of the changing global needs that our students will need. We can't educate them for our past. We need to educate them for their future. I have that track record of fighting to ensure that our families, that every student can choose the educational opportunity that their child needs. And I've established the consistency, continuity, and credibility that is needed to work with legislators, our school leaders, and our citizens to get the job done for students and their families.
Kirsten, can you tell me today that a student in Fargo, in West Fargo, in Bismarck, has the same K-12 education opportunities as a student in the most rural school in North Dakota?
I can tell you that they do not. Those situations are very different. A student being educated in Fargo is going to be very different than a student being educated and living in the Foreman area. Two completely different experiences. Of course, there are assets and deficits to both of those. We have made some significant gains in opening up opportunities of access for more electives, for higher, more strenuous coursework through stronger investment in our North Dakota Center for Distance Education. The North Dakota Center for Distance Ed has recently come under the purview of the state superintendent, and I'm really excited about that. Center for Distance Ed was started in the 1930s, actually. The legislature created it because there were some students living in North Dakota that didn't have access to a high school but wanted to earn a North Dakota high school diploma. So they created that center, and it was initially called the Correspondence School. Well, we've come a long way since emailing packets of homework back and forth and having teachers grade it to now where we can digitally and virtually deliver our education. And I think that is a game changer. I worked hard with the legislature for the last several sessions. This most recent session in 2023, we were finally able to get a piece of legislation across the finish line that said, regardless of where a student lived or what opportunities might be available in their local school brick and mortar building, every student would have access if their parents so chose and they chose to take a course from the Center for Distance Ed, and that would be covered by their student foundation aid formula that the state paid to that school. So we are working to equalize the access of opportunity, but we still have some work to do.
Kirsten, depending on where you read, one thing is clear to me that per pupil spending in North Dakota is maybe below a national average. So the question is, does the state spend enough on education here in North Dakota?
Well, actually, our per pupil foundation aid formula is one of the higher per pupil that the state covers in the nation. And so right now, our average per pupil spending is about $14,000 per student. And on average, the state covers anywhere from 75% to 80% of that. You will not see that type of state spending comparability in most other states in the nation. Yes, there are states that spend more, but that is more of a combination of local property tax investment as well as state spending. But as you know, property taxes is a significant issue that our legislature has been trying to assist and ease. And so part of that work that they have done is to assume more of the state's responsibility. Ironically, when I was a school board president, first elected in the early 2000s, only about 35 to 40% of a cost to educate a student was covered by the state share. And there was an equity lawsuit that took place because it says clearly in our Constitution that education of our students is a state's responsibility. And so that equity lawsuit was stayed, and they came to an agreement, and we revamped our funding formula in 2008 to circa 2009, and we've been continuously improving that. But ever since then, we've moved from 35 to 40% being covered by the state to, as I said, 75 to 80%. We need to make sure that our local school districts are allocating those resources effectively. I think we have some work to do with our local school leaders, again, to help them understand what is working, where they're getting a return on their investment for their dollars, and what isn't working and they need to stop doing.
One of your competitors in this race believes that the state should no longer charge property taxes for education, and that essentially the state should fund education entirely, perhaps generating revenue in different ways. Are you comfortable with the way education is funded today?
I think we need to have, I talk about three legs of the stool on the education funding formula, and I talk about the three legs of a stool that are necessary for successful student outcomes. And so the three legs of the stool, I do believe that the state does. It is a constitutional requirement that the state provide that equitable, free access to education for all of our students. So the state does bear a significant responsibility. But I also believe in local control. I also believe that there are investments that the school community in Elgin, North Dakota, or Richardson Taylor would like to make. And I don't believe we should take away that local school district's opportunity or that local community's opportunity to say, we want a new science lab, or we want new elementary playground areas, or we want a different boiler system. Our local school districts, our community should have access. We should also have the investment from the federal government for things that they require, such as individuals with disabilities education plan, the IDEA Act. They require that, and so they should fund it. And so those three legs of the stool are important. And I believe that when everybody has an opportunity to invest, it gives them power and strength and some investment so they get engaged. I also believe in three legs of the stool in order for student outcomes. You need schools, you need families, and you need community. In order for our students to really have the outcomes, we need three legs of that stool as well.
Kirsten, in Wyoming, where I came from, the state built schools. I never participated in a bond issue election to build a school in my lifetime in Wyoming. Should that happen here?
So I'm somewhat familiar with Wyoming's funding formula for the what you're talking about is the school construction.
Correct.
There was a school. So Wyoming does cover the cost of school construction, and they have a completely separate board entity that evaluates the proposals by local school districts. And that board in their capital city determines whether or not a new boiler is needed in I will just use Richardson Taylor, or if new science labs are needed in Wilton, North Dakota. I don't believe that that's the best way to go about things. I don't know that an entity in a capital city should be putting you on a waiting list. I think, as I said, there are local school communities, there are community members. We have a school district out in Western North Dakota that is funded very little by the state, but the people in their community care about their local school district, it's Horse Creek, so very much that they vote to approve the increased property taxes because it's that valuable to them. I don't think anybody's personal right to determine how their children should be educated should be taken away from them.
Kirsten, are teachers in North Dakota adequately paid?
So I think we have a lot of work to do, both on three fronts. We have a critical teacher shortage in North Dakota right now. And I think there are three significant issues. The governor has put together a task force, and it's really uncovering these issues. I think we've always known it, but we're talking about it with data. There are three points. Teachers are not being given the respect that other professions are given. They are not given the working conditions, safe, supportive working conditions that other professions are given, and they certainly aren't being compensated as other professions are. So those are the three most significant areas. If we really truly are going to bring back the people's interest and commitment to the teaching profession, we need to attack all three of those. It's not a single answer issue, but it's all three. Working conditions, respect for the profession, and adequate pay.
Should private schools be mandated to utilize certified teachers only in North Dakota?
So North Dakota's legislature has been very clear about that. Again, I think that there's a bit of a misconception out there that the role of the state superintendent makes all of these decisions when, in fact, we are an administrative agency. And so our job, the state superintendent's job, is to ensure that the federal and state laws are implemented with fidelity in our schools. And so our legislature has been very clear on this issue. Regardless of whether you are public or private, if you are going to be approved to operate at the beginning of each school year, there are six factors that must be met each and every year. And one of those is that every school will have licensed teachers by it's a separate entity, the Education Standards and Practices Board, and that only teachers licensed in their content areas can teach those. So, for instance, you couldn't be a licensed teacher to teach high school science and be able to teach middle school math. And so our legislature is very, very clear about that. They have not wavered from that. It's been in place since I got my teaching license, you know, over 30 years ago, or actually probably almost 25 years ago now.
Enjoying our conversation with Kirsten Basler, She's the current superintendent of public instruction and is running again for re-election. Kirsten, if I were to ask you the biggest challenge your office faces today, what is it?
That one truly is a question that is critically important. I think the biggest challenge that we face in education today is really undoing the lie that every child must go to college for a four-year degree to live a good life. We've embraced since 2016 the idea of all students should graduate choice ready, whatever they choose to do. So they must have the knowledge, the skills, and the disposition, you know, the soft skills to do whatever they choose to do after high school, whether it's that four-year degree or if it's entering the workforce with a certificate or some sort of technical credential or enlisting in the military. And so we've implemented the choice-ready requirement in all of our high schools. But we really, really have to change the mindset of, you know, most citizens in North Dakota to say that we can and should invest just as much in our apprenticeship programs as we do in what we invest as taxpayers for supporting the average college student. And so I'd say that is the biggest challenge that we have. But an equally troubling challenge that we have is also that some of our students are trapped in chronically low-performing school districts. And for the first time in North Dakota history, beginning in 2025, the legislature has provided the state superintendent the authority to directly intervene in any school that is identified as chronically low-performing and has failed to improve on its own. So even though the Department of Public Instruction, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, aren't allowed to implement this and put anything into action until 2025, we're working really hard. I'm working really hard leading the team to make sure that we are ready to provide the necessary support to those schools so those students in those schools can graduate with the knowledge, skills, and disposition that they deserve to have to do whatever they choose to do in life. And then finally, I would say, the third biggest challenge is that not all of our school boards are engaging in the North Dakota Be Legendary School Board training. I'll explain that a little bit. It was created in DPI to help our school boards set expectations that are absolutely necessary to improve student outcomes. The legislature spends over $1 billion each year on K-12 education. And I will tell you again, this is where the superintendent of public instruction is hired to be the administrative agent. 98% of that funding is delivered directly out the door to our local school boards to solely decide how to spend it. And so in 2023, Senate Bill 2013 provided funding for the state superintendent to train all of our North Dakota school board members on how to make good policy and spending decisions focused on student academic outcomes. And I'm going to say that again, focused on student academic outcomes. There's a lot of things that our school boards are talking about, but very little of it is about how well are our students doing. So this legislature made this training voluntary for our school boards, and to date, 49 school boards have chosen to be trained and are engaged in this program, but that means that there's another 119 boards that still need the training so they can ensure that the 98% of that $1 billion each year is being spent on the reasons that schools exist, and that is to achieve student outcomes.
Kirsten, I want to talk to you about school safety and mental health. First, a real general question, but I think really important.
Mm-hmm.
If you could, what would your advice be to middle schools and high schools relative to cell phones?
So there's a growing body of evidence as it relates to cell phones that says that when our students aren't distracted by that during the day, their mental health grows up. Their academic outcomes increase, and the long-term health and well-being of both the students and the teachers in those classrooms increases. So I know that there are some school districts across the state that have adopted a no cell phone policy. I know that there are more that have attempted to, but it's a really hard policy to enact and to regulate. And so I think we do need to get serious about the conversation. Interestingly, this is an issue that my student cabinet has taken up as well. As you may know, Craig, about 8 years ago, I initiated a student cabinet because for the first time in my education career, I was making bigger decisions that were impacting more and more students, a larger number of students, and assisting our legislators in making good policy decisions, yet I didn't have a direct connection to those students that we were trying to serve anymore. So I started the Student Cabinet. This is a group of, you know, about 25 young people from fourth grade all the way up to freshmen in college, or some have gone the first year of their military academy, still attend our meetings virtually. They advise me on what I need, what the state needs to continue to do because it's working well. They advise us on what we should start doing because there's a need there. And they advise us also on what we need to stop doing because it's not helpful to them in being successful. This student cabinet, this most recent student cabinet, has taken up the issue of mental health and well-being, just health and well-being of both their peers as students and their teachers. And one of the things that they identified is the impact, the significant negative impact of social media and the cell phone use and social media presence in their day-to-day classrooms.
So to take this to the next level then, are North Dakota schools adequately funded relative to the mental health resources that they can provide students?
So, well, the first thing that I would say is that I think we need to stop thinking about or eradicate the idea that we need to fund mental health in schools and then we have to fund mental health in our communities. We have 780,000 people in the entire state of North Dakota. So our human resources are our most precious precious resource and very scarce. And so what we need to do, and we've tried to model this at the state level, rather than having our school districts or the Department of Public Instruction replicate our mental health services within our agency, we need to be better partners with our health and human services that are responsible for all health. And health is health. We have mental health and we have physical health. And I would say I would give that same advice to our local school districts, our local school boards, as they're trying to determine how to spend their money. Don't try to hire away those social workers or those school psychologists and make them a school employee, but be better partners with the resources that exist both in public entities with your human service centers and your human service zones that already exist in our communities and the private entities of our health clinics, our both mental health and physical health clinics. I think if we're trying to compete for those very few social workers, very few school psychiatrists or child psychologists, that we're only going to be robbing Peter to pay Paul and we're not going to get anywhere. So the way that I advocate for this and the way that when I advise legislators that ask me to weigh in on this is to not separately fund mental health services in schools, but how do we break down the red tape and remove the bureaucracy that exists so our school districts can work more seamlessly with our human service centers and our human service zones and our private entities that already exist in our communities.
Kristen, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you about libraries. There's certainly been a lot of discussion about books, but more generally, what's your vision of the role of school libraries in promoting literacy and learning? And who should choose what's in a library?
So this is very interesting because I was a computer science integrator, computer technology integrator, and spent my first part of my year as a formative years as a library media specialist when they were first coming to be. So again, I'm going to go back to that three-legged stool. I'm going to say that in order for a student's outcomes to be the best that they can be, it needs all legs of that stool. It needs school. It needs community and it needs families. And so each community is going to have a different bar and a different level for what is acceptable. And I think it's critical that every school district have a reconsideration policy for what is acceptable that meet the norms and expectations. We can't do that in isolation. There is no entity. A librarian should not be making that decision in a vacuum. A school district, a school board should not be making that decision in a vacuum. And communities can't make that decision in a vacuum because they send their children to schools every day. And so those three legs of that stool need to come together to determine what's appropriate and at what age level is appropriate.
Kirsten Baszler, she's the current Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of North Dakota. Kirsten, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
That was current State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Kirsten Baszler. We will hear from two of her three opponents, including Jim Bartlett tomorrow and Jason Heitkamp on Wednesday. Dakota Datebook is next.
For Americans living in rural communities, getting proper access to medical treatment can be challenging.
If we have someone who comes in that we think is having a heart attack, we have to send it to Athens because we have no cardiology in town.
In our series, We the Voters, we examine the state of healthcare in rural Georgia. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 3rd. On this date in 1905, the Weekly Student, the University of North Dakota student newspaper, reported, "One of the most pleasant and successful social functions of the year was the garden party which was given by the ADT Society last Monday evening to the other literary societies and the faculty." News of Japan's victory had reached the university, but a few hours before the guests began to arrive, and they were much surprised that the lawn of Davis Hall had been transformed, as by magic, into a celestial picture. Japanese lanterns cast their mellow light over the scene, and two beautiful Japanese maids, who had been spirited away from the land of the rising sun, soon began to serve tea in dainty cups to the wandering natives. The guests listened to news, which arrived that day, about the Battle of Tsushima Strait. After an epic journey to Japan, most of Imperial Russia's Baltic fleet sank to the bottom in a dramatic naval battle. On a gentler note, the guests then listened to a piano duet by Mrs. Brennan and Crary, followed by a performance by what would now be called a barbershop quartet. They ate strawberries and ice cream, after which a Mr. Walker, presumably a member of the faculty, gave a talk. The party closed with the ADT Literary Society singing "Good Night." The Weekly Student commented, "These social functions, in which one society invites all the others to participate, are the most pleasant features of our college life. The societies which have been opposed to each other in the forensic contest during the year are, at its close, again brought together under conditions which are more harmonious. Their members leave the school with a feeling of peace and goodwill toward all." UND students celebrating a Japanese victory speaks to the sentiments of the times decades before World War II. It would be several months before the Russian and Japanese Empire signed the Treaty of Portsmouth. Those negotiations had taken place in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and were brokered in part by President Theodore Roosevelt. Japan was the Asiatic underdog, a rooting favorite in the battle against the great Russian bear. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Farvel. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for joining us today.
And thank you for that top-of-the-hour interview, Ashley. Really appreciated it. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be joined by Jen Lee to discuss North Dakota legal services and explore who can benefit from their vital assistance. Additionally, we'll continue our series of interviews with candidates for State Superintendent of Public Instruction with a conversation featuring Jim Bartlett.
Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.
Coming up on 4 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock Mountain, you're listening to member-supported Prairie Public. Forecast for late this afternoon, calling for a mostly cloudy sky in the northwest, partly cloudy elsewhere, isolated to scattered thunderstorms developing in the western portion of the state. A few could possibly become strong to severe. We'll be tracking that throughout the afternoon. Tonight, mostly cloudy, showers and thunderstorms becoming more widespread as they move central and eventually eastern North Dakota.